From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogay, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, cracking some of New York City's most infamous cases, we talk with homicide detective Thomas McKenna. He's worked on the Central Park jogger case, the Preppy murder, and the Brooklyn Bridge shootings. He has a new book about his 30 years on the force. Also, improvisational screenwriting. We talk with director Jim McKay and with actress Lily Taylor about the new film Girlstown. It won 2 awards at this year's Sundance Film Festival. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Bob Dole is preparing for the most important speech of his political career. He addresses the Republican National Convention this evening in San Diego as he accepts the GOP presidential nomination. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold says Dole's speech has been months in the making.
He's been working on the speech for 4 months with speechwriter and novelist, actually, Mark Helperin, who helped him write his resignation speech, and he was happy with it for the last 4 months and tinkered with it around the margins. But in the last few days, the pressure has increased. He's taken another look at it, and he's decided he wanted to change it. And he's had 2 of his old speechwriters from the Senate come in and start working on it to the extent that Mark Helperin, who wrote the bulk of it, left town and no longer has pride of ownership.
NPR's Elizabeth Arnold in San Diego. A lobby group is cautioning churches not to pass out voter guides from the Christian Coalition if they don't want to risk their tax-exempt status. The group, People for the American Way, issued the warning. It comes in the wake of a Federal Election Commission lawsuit against the tax-exempt Christian Coalition over its guides and activities. The FEC alleges the guides improperly promote Republican candidates. A spokesman for the group, People for the American Way, says it does not oppose churches distributing political material as long as it is not partisan. The Christian Coalition says this warning is harassment. A low-level emergency has been declared at a Florida nuclear power plant. The Fort Pierce officials say there's been an act of sabotage there. Jill Roberts of member station WQCS reports.
3 switches in a backup control room of the St. Lucie nuclear power plant were locked in place with glue, according to Florida Power and Light, which runs the plant. The switches would have been used to shut down the plant if, for some reason, the main control room were not able to do so. FP&L officials say public safety was never compromised. Dale Thomas, an FP&L spokesman, says the backup control room where the glue was found is not easily accessible.
A portion of the plant workforce has access to this area. Most visitors would be escorted by someone if they were in that area of the plant.
Thomas says they're considering offering a reward to anyone who can supply information as to who may have tampered with the switches. For National Public Radio, I'm Jill Roberts in Fort Pierce, Florida.
The Vatican reports Pope John Paul II is slightly ill. The Pope is at his summer residence in Italy. He missed noon Mass today because of what's reported as a mild stomach illness. John Paul had a CAT scan last night as part of regular testing following bowel surgery that took place 4 years ago. The Vatican says last night's tests showed nothing was the matter. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down about 1.5 at 5,665. This is NPR. Russia's new security chief is back in Chechnya. Alexander Lebed has been granted sweeping new powers to end the warfare there. Lebed met today with Russian officials and military commanders outside the Chechen capital, Grozny. He's also planning to meet with the top rebel commander and a Chechen political leader. Lebed is showing his anger over the continued fighting. The Interfast news agency quotes him as saying the best soldiers on both sides are fighting for no clear reason. Lebed's mission follows a major rebel offensive on Grozny. The rebels have taken control of the city's center. Hundreds of Russian soldiers have been killed. A Palestinian accused of masterminding 3 suicide attacks earlier this year allegedly received training in Syria and Iran. He's being held in Israeli custody until the end of his trial. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
According to the indictment read in an Israeli military court, 25-year-old Hassan Salama masterminded three suicide bombings in February and March that killed 45 people and injured more than 90. Israeli troops captured Salama by chance at a routine roadblock in the West Bank in May. He told the court he received orders to arrange the bombings from Mohammed Deif, the head of Hamas's military wing, who remains at large. He said the bombings were to avenge the assassination of master Palestinian bombmaker Yahya Ayash, killed by a booby-trapped cellular phone in January, allegedly by Israel. Salama told reporters that Hamas did not intend to influence Israel's elections and simply wanted to kill Israelis. The suicide bombings are believed to have been a major factor in hardline Likud leader Benjamin Netanyahu's victory in May. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
The wives of three Gulf War veterans are blaming the U.S. government for their children's birth defects. They're suing the government for $60 million, saying the Pentagon negligently allowed their husbands to be exposed to pesticides and petrochemicals. Experts say the lawsuit probably will not succeed. I'm Korva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. Thomas McKenna is a 32-year veteran of Manhattan North Homicide, the elite detective force of the New York City Police Department. The squad covers all murders that occur north of 59th Street in Manhattan, river to river. McKenna has helped solve many of the city's most publicized crimes, including the rape and beating of the Central Park jogger in 1989 and the slaying of high school senior Jennifer Levin by Robert Chambers, dubbed the Preppy Murder by the press. His new book about working the murder beat is Manhattan North Homicide. Actors such as Sean Penn, Michael Douglas, and John Turturro have shadowed McKenna in preparation for roles as police detectives to learn the lingo and the gestures of a real cop. McKenna says it usually doesn't take very long before a case starts coming together.
Basically, you can get a feeling on which way you're going within the first 24 hours. 72 hours, absolutely. You know whether you're going to be in it for the long run or whether you'll have a successful conclusion in the short run. Homicides are strange things. The answer to every homicide is in the street. So you have to be willing to get out into the street, go out and speak to the people, and work. You just can't sit back. It's not going to come to you. You have to go out and get it. And in New York City, we've been very, very lucky. I hate to say very, very good, but the truth of the matter is that if you're willing to go out and do your job, it makes it a lot easier.
What percentage of your cases get solved?
I think presently we're solving approximately 72% of the homicides that are committed. However, we do have probably another 16% that we know who is responsible for the homicide, but we do not have enough to prosecute the case in court. So in reality, the solvability factor, you must understand the nature of the beast. In a lot of cases, we have narcotics involved. If you have homicides that are not narcotic involvement, generally speaking, we will clear approximately 95% of those cases. When you add in the drug element, it brings the statistics down in clearing the cases because of the witness fear factor. And in a lot of cases, it takes you 3 weeks to find out who's dead, never mind solving the case. You get a call with a body in the trunk or a call with a body, the car is stolen, there's no identification on the individual, you take fingerprints, he's got no criminal record. And 2 weeks later, you find out that somebody's calling from the medical examiner's office, that the family of the deceased is down at the medical examiner's office to claim the body, and you say, well, where is he from? And they tell you Dominican Republic or Colombia. And ultimately, the family found out through a phone call that was made to them that your son is dead in New York City. So it's the drug culture that keeps the homicide clearance rates down to a level where it's unacceptable to us.
So since they live in an underground culture, it makes everything murkier. You don't have all the clues that you can add up when someone's identification checks out.
Usually on what we call a dump job, a homicide where they just dump the body someplace, they usually place it in an area that is not well-traveled. because they don't want to get caught when they do it. So they just leave the body. Now, when you get to the scene of a crime, all you have is a body. You don't have anything other than the person that might have found the body, who was most of the time walking their dog. So you're starting with just a dead body, and you don't know who it is. And the best part about solving homicides, or the thing that makes homicides easily solved or easier to solve, is knowing who the dead person is. If you know your victim, the chances of your solving the case are much better.
You worked on the Central Park jogger case in 1989, in which a young woman jogger was beaten, raped, and left for dead by a group of young men, boys, really. How did you track down the suspects?
That was a complete team participation type of investigation. When the young lady was found early in the morning hours, we did a look at who and what happened in Central Park for the prior 24 hours. And we realized that there had been a group of young people in the park who had been arrested for acts of robbery and assault. We took that information, and those people had been released to their parents earlier that night. They were arrested, but because of their ages, they were released to the custody of their parents. Armed with that information, we went out to re-interview these people. There was a dual purpose in doing that. The first purpose was we wanted to interview them to see if they knew anything, if they had seen anything. And the second purpose was to find out if they were actively involved in the case. What ultimately happened was we wound up getting all of these individuals, interviewing almost everybody that was in the park that night. And through a process of elimination, we were able to zero in, per se, on about eight. Ten youths were actively involved in some manner, shape, or form in that area of the park where the jogger was found. As a result of the interviews, seven were charged. In my particular case, I had one young man who denied being in the park. I had other people telling me that he was in the park, and he denied that he had any participation, and in fact denied that he was even in Central Park.
So that immediately raised your hackles.
Absolutely, absolutely. I had interviewed maybe four or five other young men that day, and they all admitted that they had been in the park, but that they had seen what was going on, and they left. There was nobody that said that those particular individuals had done anything wrong. So, I mean, there was no reason to hold them. We let them go. However, when I get him in, Yousef Salam is his name, he tells me he wasn't in Central Park at all. Knowing that other people had put him there, I immediately said, something's wrong here. And we sat down and we had an interview, a talk, and approximately an hour later he admitted to what he had done, and in essence what he had done was he had hit the jogger herself with a lead pipe. He had hit her twice and knocked her down.
What technique did you use to get him to crack?
Well, in essence, it was the fact that I told him I had fingerprints on the shorts of the jogger.
And that wasn't quite true.
No, it was absolutely not true. Absolutely a lie.
Now, is that kind of lie common in an interrogation?
Well, we don't beat people in an interrogation or in an interview. You are allowed to use certain ruses. You are allowed to use untruths. We can use, through the courts, they have allowed us to do this. I mean, to outwardly tell an untruth. What, in essence, this thing did was when I told him that if I took his prints and they matched the prints that I had on the shorts, he was going to be arrested for rape. And he knows that he didn't rape her. You see, there is a thing in the criminal world or in the inner cities that says it's okay to rob, and it might be okay to pillage, but you can't rape. Rapists in jail are held in lower regard, or actually no regard at all, as compared to a murderer. I mean, you could be a murderer and be held in more or less esteem in the jail community, whereas if you're a rapist, you or a child molester, you have no status at all in jail. And that filters out of the jails and into the streets. And for somebody, Yousef Salaam was basically a moral kid. I mean, his mother worked hard to make him a little bit better. He himself went to a Catholic high school. He went to Rice High School, which is a Catholic high school in Harlem. And the kids, he had morals which were normal. And the thought of being convicted or arrested for rape because his fingerprints were on those shorts positively turned him off. He couldn't deal with that.
How does a moral kid beat a woman over the head with a pipe?
Well, I'm going to say that it was probably mob mentality. Okay? In other words, individually, there's not one of those young men would have done anything in that park on a one-on-one basis. However, when they went into the park with a mob mentality, they all became a mob. They became not the person that went into the park, but a member, a faceless person in a crowd. And that's what took over with this group. It was the mob mentality, the face in a crowd type mentality.
Let's get back to this issue of lying in an interrogation. Mm-hmm. At what point does lying become unethical or coercion? At what point can it get you in trouble with the defense when it comes to trial?
Well, I was asked when I testified, isn't it a fact that you lied? And the bottom line was I had. So you go on the stand, and what you do is you have to be believed. You have a jury, and if you say, well, you know, I didn't lie, which in fact really I did. I guess I said it was an untruth, a fib, an untruth, and in essence a lie. However, to get before a jury, to tell the jury that this is what you did in order to obtain a confession, and then the judge tells him it's allowed under law, is to my way of thinking, putting it all on the table with the jury. Now it's a matter of them believing you or them believing the defendant. And in this case, the acts that were done were so horrible. And the injury sustained by the lady were so detrimental to her being. When she testified at that trial, I mean, she showed the her face was still scarred. She waddled. She couldn't walk. This is a lady who was vibrant, who was young, who was beautiful. And they just took everything away from her. The jury in this particular case looked at her and looked at these young men and said, somebody has to be held accountable for the actions that took place in the park.
You escorted the victim to court, and obviously it's rare in your job to have a victim still alive to interact with.
That's correct.
What effect did it have on you to meet the victim?
I had seen the victim at the hospital, and I thought that she was just going to be another one of the many victims that brings my office, the Homicide Squad from Manhattan North, into an investigation. The thought of her surviving never even entered into my mind. The case was handled as a homicide from the beginning. The investigation was conducted as a homicide from the beginning, and the homicide with no witnesses. However, that changed in a matter of 48 hours. We had the case basically concluded. And when I met her for the first time and spoke to her, I was delighted to meet her. I was shocked. I was encouraged by her willingness to participate in the trial. Here's a young lady who really couldn't offer anything to the prosecution except her presence, because her knowledge and memory of the events that took place in the park that night, she didn't have any recollection of those events. All she could do was tell us what happened prior to her going into the park as best as she could remember, and then waking up in a hospital months later, you know.
You wrote that the Central Park jogger case almost cost you your marriage. Why?
Well, I wrote that. It shook my marriage, but it never. My marriage really was never in question. I spent so many hours doing that case. I mean, I was doing 16 hours a day, 7 days a week, for a period of 8 months. My wife has never questioned what I do at work. She did, however, question why I had to be away from home so many hours, so many days, for a period of 6 to 8 months. She couldn't understand that. And she's not supposed to understand that. In a lot of, I think, 3 or 4 marriages that dissolved as a result of the Jarga case.
My guest is Thomas McKenna. He is a homicide detective. He's served on the NYPD for more than 30 years. He has a new book about his experiences on the force called Manhattan North Homicide. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Police Detective Thomas McKenna. His new book about his work with the NYPD is called Manhattan North Homicide. You tell a story about an incident where you did have to draw your gun. It's about a guy named, you call Fogel. It happened in Charlie's Bar outside of New York City. The bartender had seen him with a gun, that he was carrying a gun in the bar, and that he was threatening other people in the bar. That it sounded like an incident to you in which the guy was a drug dealer and perhaps a deal had gone sour. So you go into the bar at about 1 o'clock in the morning after your shift, and this guy's there, and the bartender's asking you to take charge of the situation and just disarm him. Tell us what happened.
Well, as I pulled up, the bartender knew my car, and he came out to me and he said, listen, Fogel's in the bar again. He was there last night. He pulled a gun last night. He pulled a gun tonight. And he's got the gun, and it's sticking out of his belt right in front of him. I told the bartender to go back inside and go to the other end of the bar and not to come near me at all. I asked him how many people were in the place. He told me that it was almost empty. I said, okay. As I walked into the establishment, the bar was directly in front of me, running left to right. Fogel was at the right-hand side of the bar. I immediately went right over to him, and as I approached him, he took his sweater and he put it over the gun. He had the gun sticking out of his belt. And the bartender said, how you doing? I said, fine. He said, tough night. I said, yeah, tough night. Give me a bottle of beer. And he served the bottle of beer and he walked away. At that point, the door opened behind me. And Fogel's attention was now directed towards the door again. And as he turned back, I grabbed the handle of the gun, I pulled my gun, and I told him to just relax and put his hands up. He didn't do that. He used an expletive, and at that point, he pushed me and attempted to go for his gun, which he did. He pulled it out, and I fired one shot, and I hit him.
What do most suspects do when you draw your weapon on them?
They usually, a bright person would normally comply with what directives are given to him. I mean, if somebody put a gun in my face, I would comply. What can you do? I mean, basically, this guy, in talking to him later, he said, I knew you were a cop. However, I didn't think you had jurisdiction outside the city of New York. Ergo, I guess he felt that I was just another guy in the street, and he could do whatever he wanted.
You thought after this happened, after you shot him and you were waiting for police to apprehend him, local police, that your mistake was that you didn't shout at the guy, that you were too nice.
Exactly, exactly. I thought, and in reflection on that, too often people misconstrued kindness for weakness. And I have learned over the years that it's a business. And you have to treat it as business. Nobody wants to go to jail. Nobody wants to have their freedoms taken away from them. criminal or civilian, or legitimate upstanding citizens. Nobody wants you to take away their freedoms. And in doing so, especially with the criminal element, you have to treat it as a business. You cannot be nice, you cannot be friendly until after the handcuffs are on. And then it's, I mean, that's business. That's the way it's got to be. Nobody's going to pick up my paycheck and bring it home every 2 weeks to my wife and my family if I don't do it. And if I put myself in a position where I'm endangering myself, sooner or later it's going to catch up to me and I'm going to be the one that's hurt.
What's the most dangerous kind of arrest, or what circumstances make for a dangerous arrest for you?
I've always found that domestic problems were probably the most difficult. When you arrest an individual in his house, in front of his wife and in front of his family, it tends to be a little more dangerous than when you're just out in the street and you're just locking somebody up out in the street. And the reason for that is people are embarrassed that they're being placed in handcuffs in front of their children. And this is where business comes in. I honestly mean this. When you have to go into somebody's house to arrest them, the quicker you get the cuffs on them, the better off everybody's going to be. And when you dilly or dally in an apartment with a guy's family, he tends to huff up and get courage, and it can be a bad situation. Then you have to deal with him, you have to deal with crying children, you have to deal with a wife who's upset and sometimes attacks you from behind when you're trying to arrest her husband. So it just is a problem. I don't like I'd rather take an individual on the street than in a house anytime, because on the street I can control the situation. In an apartment, it's always a little more dangerous.
Your colleagues say you have an uncanny ability to tell when a suspect is conning you. What clues do you look for? How do they give themselves away?
I would say, well, the first thing I do is develop eye contact. When I'm in a room with an individual, I demand eye contact. I do not let him look at the ceiling. I do not let him look at the ground. And I try to basically control his eye movement. And I find that people, when you interview or interrogate people, the eye contact is the giveaway one way or the other. This is my personal feeling.
Thomas McKenna's book about his years on the New York police force is Manhattan North Homicide. We'll hear more from Thomas McKenna in the second half of our show. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we hear more from New York homicide detective Thomas McKenna. Also, an experiment in improvisational screenwriting. Director Jim McKay and actress Lily Taylor describe their collaboration on Girlstown, a new film about teenage girls. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. My guest is Thomas McKenna. He's been a homicide detective for more than 30 years for the New York City Police. In his new book, Manhattan North Homicide, he writes about some of his more notorious cases. You also worked on another highly publicized case. The press dubbed it the Preppy Murder. It happened in the summer of 1986. A high school senior, Jennifer Levin, was found dead in Central Park. She'd been strangled. The investigation focused pretty quickly on a former prep school student, Robert Chambers. How did you narrow things down to him?
Well, Jennifer Levin was in an establishment on the East Side with a bunch of her friends, and she left that establishment with Robert Chambers. And then the next morning, she was found dead in Central Park. Now, it doesn't take a brain surgeon to realize that you have to go out and speak to the people who last saw her to try and find out what happened. We wanted to talk to Robert Chambers because he was the last one, to our knowledge, that had seen her alive. We did have doormen who saw them walking on 86th Street going towards Central Park. And to find out exactly what happened to her, we had to speak to the people that saw her last. And Robert Chambers was one of the people that saw her last. We didn't know if he was the person responsible for her death or not, but we had to speak to him.
Under questioning, he stuck to a barely plausible story. Mm-hmm. But he did eventually crack. My question is, why do suspects talk at all? Why not just ask for a lawyer and keep your mouth shut?
To this day, I'll never be able to figure it out either. Chambers wanted to talk to everybody. Chambers was so sure that he'd get over on everybody that the thought of him ever putting himself in a jackpot never even dawned on him. When he was picked up the morning that she was found, he had scratches on his neck. The two detectives, Frank Connolly was one of them from my office. They picked him up at his house and never said a word to him about the scratches on his neck. When he was delivered to the Central Park precinct by the two detectives, he was put in a room and allowed to just sit there for a while. He said, "What is this about?" They said, "Well, you know, Jennifer Levin was found last night, this morning, and we need your help in assisting us to find out exactly what happened to her." And that was, in essence, the truth. However, when they got him into Central Park, they relayed the information that they had, namely that he had scratches on his neck, to the detectives that were involved in the actual investigation of the case. And armed with that, and other information that they had gotten from doormen and people that were on 86th Street and people that were in Dorian's, the bar that they had earlier been in, they went into the room loaded with as much ammunition as they had. And after hours and hours and hours, he finally fessed up to doing what he did. And what happens in a lot of cases is the people don't want to take responsibility for what they do, so they blame the deceased. In this particular case, he blamed poor Jennifer Levin, who, of course, we couldn't interview and nobody could interview. He blamed her for rough sex. I mean, my God, how inane can you be? This guy was 6'3". He weighed over 200 pounds. Poor Jennifer was a little bit of a thing. And this murderer, for lack of anything else, because that's exactly what he is, attempted to tell us that she was responsible for her own death because of rough sex. I mean, how insane can you be?
You said that people can read about a murder in the newspaper and still not understand. But if they see where someone was killed, it has a completely different effect. What does seeing a murder scene make you understand?
Well, it probably makes you understand that homicide or murder is the mother of all crime. You can't make restitution for homicide. You can't make restitution for a murder. You can't go to somebody and say, "I'm sorry that I killed your son," or "I'm sorry I killed your daughter," or "your father," or your mother. You can't do that. If you do a robbery, 15 years later, you can come up to that person and say, "Listen, I was sorry I did this 15 years ago. Here's your $1,000 back." You can never do that in a murder case. You cannot say you're sorry in a murder case because there is no justification for taking another person's life for self-gain or for whatever reason. Crimes of passion, the haves, the have-nots, stealing. Somebody prevents you from taking their watch or their wallet or their pocketbook, and in doing so you pull them under a car and they die. How do you justify taking somebody's life for a matter of $10 or $15? I don't understand it. And in some cases, I've seen people get killed over a parking spot. I mean, how stupid can you be to take somebody's life because they pulled in to a parking spot that you were waiting for? Come on. You know, where is the mentality that allows people to pull a gun and kill somebody over a parking spot? What kind of education do they have? What kind of family life? What kind of values do they have? What kind of values do they have for human life when they do this? It's mind-boggling. It's what makes the job interesting. It's no two homicides are alike. They're all different.
Thomas McKenna, I want to thank you very much for talking with me today.
I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you very much.
Thomas McKenna is a veteran homicide detective in New York City. His book is Manhattan North Homicide. Coming up, we talk with director Jim McKay and actress Lily Taylor about the new film, Girls Town. This is Fresh Air. This year, a slew of new movies feature teenage girls, among them Mannion Lowe, Foxfire, and Girls Town. Girls Town follows the lives and friendships of a tight group of high school seniors, Nikki, Angela, Emma, and Patty, as they struggle with questions surrounding abortion, suicide, rape, and their own futures. Girls Town won the Filmmakers Trophy and a special jury prize at this year's Sundance Festival. Jim McKay is the director of the film. He's also directed music videos for such bands as R.E.M., Ziggy Marley, and Pylon. Lily Taylor plays the role of Patty. She's a tough single mother with an abusive ex-boyfriend. In this scene, Patty's walking down the street with Angela, played by Brooklyn Harris, when a parks worker, played by Michael Imperioli, gives her a hard time.
I want to play today, you know? It's our day off.
I know, right? I'm saying.
We should go to Max's, though. You should get those pants.
Oh, yeah, you think they're cool?
They're super cool on you.
Yo, baggy pants, why don't you let me crawl in those pants with you?
Oh, God.
I could if you come back in 5. I got a break coming up.
No, he didn't. No.
Angela, I'm so sick of it.
Look.
What's up?
Yeah, what? A lot. I got a problem with you. You got no respect, man. What's your problem?
I got respect for you.
No, you don't. If some guy talked to your girlfriend, your mother that way, I think you'd have a problem with that.
Yeah, but I ain't got no girlfriend.
That's a big surprise.
Why?
Because you an asshole.
Why don't you come back in 5, cutie? Come back and see me.
Right. In your dreams.
Girls Town evolved out of a collaboration between McKay and his actors in improvisational workshops. The whole cast shares the screenwriting credit. Before casting, McKay even tested out the themes for the film by talking with a group of five women.
From the very beginning, I was really open to other people's ideas. I really felt strongly that I knew what I wanted to say, but I was really interested in hearing what other people would like told. And so, you know, we talked about a lot of different things. Should these girls be in college or high school, for instance, was a big topic of discussion. Should the lesbian experience come into play at some point in the story? What part should men or boys play in the story? Things like that. Just kind of throwing around ideas, kind of getting a feel for what was out there. You know, for me, that was an important place to start. And I know consensus kind of creativity is definitely not a favorite of a lot of people. But for me, it just, you know, it seemed to make sense.
And how did you arrive upon the conviction that you'd make a film about teenage girls in high school?
Well, there's definitely, I think, a moment in the growing up of a girl, and a boy for that matter, where there's a lot more freedom, I think, and a lot less, a lot more freedom in a more of like a cathartic and spontaneous way. And there's a little bit less attention paid to certain rules, you know. I also think for college girls undergoing the experience that the girls in Girlstown do, there would have been much more of a kind of book knowledge to be put into place. The girls in Girlstown are not, you know, women's studies students. They're just regular girls kind of coming upon things that will influence their future. And I think it was a really good choice because I think it's really enjoyable and fun and interesting to watch the girls in the story kind of just stumble their way through a lot of this stuff and by the end really become on their way to being those college girls that we may have made the film about in the first place.
Lily, when you were cast, what did you know about your character, Patty?
I knew that she was based on this character, the Linda Mann's character from Out of the Blue, this Dennis Hopper movie. Kind of like, I kind of thought of it as Tatum O'Neill from Paper Moon had grown up, you know, kind of tomboyish, rebellious, and maybe kind of a little bit punk in a way or alternative. I think she was also maybe like she was rebellious and coming from her gut, but a little bit more kind of intellectual than she ended up being. Not that she's not smart, it's not like that, but she comes from her gut completely.
Jim assembled your cast and started a 5-day workshop process, which you later said lasted for months, actually. But on the first day, Jim, you planned a trip to Hackensack, New Jersey. Now, why Hackensack? What did you expect to find there?
Well, I went to high school in Hackensack, and it wasn't that far from Manhattan, so it was a kind of easy place to start for me because I saw that it was that kind of a town that I was looking at, a town where you had a real vast mix of class and culture and race. And so I thought it would be good to take all the actors there and kind of walk around and, you know, see where everybody lived, kind of get a feel for the environment, because I didn't know how many of the actors, you know, had actually, you know, spent a lot of time outside of Manhattan, what their experiences was, and I thought it would be good to kind of get that in our heads before we actually started working in this small apartment downtown Manhattan.
So, Lily, you signed on for this movie, you have your part, and all of a sudden you're in Hackensack in the pouring rain walking around. What did you think? What did I get myself into?
No, I mean, also, I'd known Jim. I'd been friends with Jim, so I wasn't that surprised by any of it. But I realized, like, that the Hackensack wasn't really working, that approach. Like, I feel like it was really, like, just getting in that room, putting that camera on, and us, you know, getting up, falling down for 6 weeks. That's really where the stuff happened. We tried some kind of outdoor experiences and research experiences, but it just didn't feel right. It felt a little bit forced.
Like what? Like following people around or what?
Well, the day in Hackensack, like, you know, we were trying to kind of almost like imagine that we lived there and walk around and that might be your house, that might be yours, and do kind of like some imagining stuff. But it just, it just didn't work. I mean, also because we were like in this high school mentality, and part of that is sort of rejecting anything anybody suggests, you know, particularly an authority figure. So that sort of was appropriate. We were like, oh, he wants us to go to Hackensack, and you know, and I part of me was like, I think this is kind of an appropriate mentality. I think we're here. I think we're in character. But so I don't know. I just said, let's get in that room and let's just get going and just do it. I think it's all in there inside of us, you know.
One character in the movie admits to her friends that she'd been a victim of date rape, and date rape and rape figure pretty prominently in the action of the movie. And this friend had never told anyone because she didn't know what to say, she said. And when she then tells her story, your character, Lily, mm-hmm. essentially blames her for being stupid, for getting mm-hmm. into the car with the guy, for leading him on. Mm-hmm. How did you decide to play the scene that way? Why was it your character that would have that reaction?
Well, because I feel like sometimes when you come from the gut, you can lack compassion and understanding. And you just think the way you do things is the way everyone should do things. And so that's kind of where that was coming from. Fear of also seeing some truth that she didn't want to see about her own condition made her uncomfortable. And so she was reacting, you know, out of fear. I felt it was really important because to have that point of view in, that things are messy. People don't, you know, treat you nice and understand, and it's not gentle. A lot of times there's, you know, especially with women, there's a lot of, you know, we're kind of just evolving. We're sort of learning about how we all feel about things, you know, and we just sort of started talking. It's still a new thing. I mean, you know what I'm saying? Like, sort of starting in the 70s, you know what I'm saying?
Sure.
So I feel like we have to sort of be true to the mess that's there and the differences.
Lily Taylor stars in the new film, Girlstown. Jim McKay is the director of the movie. We'll be back after this short break. This is Fresh Air. With Jim McKay and Lily Taylor. Jim McKay is the director of the new film Girlstown. Lily Taylor plays the role of Patty, a single mother in her senior year in high school, in the movie. Lily, you had a pretty tough time in high school. You've talked about suffering from depression when you were in school. Did you draw on your own experience in collaborating for the film?
Not much, actually. My experience was very different. But, you know, I think that with adolescence, like, what I realize is sort of the same essences remain true, you know, and the different styles or language or externals change, you know, but I could relate to the same basic essence, you know, which is being uncomfortable, confused, you know, forming your identity.
Not fitting in.
Not fitting in, for sure, for sure, for sure. If anything, it was a way for me to, Patty was a little bit more, She got hip a little sooner to this kind of being enlightened to being treated a certain way. You know what I mean? I didn't get that till after high school, about that there was a certain level that I should be treated. I didn't have that in high school.
That you deserved something.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I didn't have as much self-respect as Patty has. Even though she puts herself into, you know, some denigrating situations, she has an element of self-respect that I was lacking.
Well, there's a scene in which Patty, your character, gets some sweet talk from a guy on the street who's working. And it's like, yo, baggy pants, why don't you let me crawl in those pants with you? And she goes right up to him and challenges him mm-hmm. for it, which is something I think every woman fantasizes about. And it's something everyone has to deal with every day.
That's right.
People catcalling them on the street. But for a teenager, when you're so self-conscious about your sexuality, it's just excruciating.
Exactly.
Did you ever call a guy on it?
After high school, a lot. Like, I was almost making up for lost time, you know, calling everybody on it. Yeah. I mean, I had respect and stuff in high school. I think high school's a scary time also, and for a lot of women I know, it's a very scary to take a stand against a man, because it seems like you'll lose too much if you go against a man, you know? Mm-hmm. If you break up, then they'll hate you. You may not get another boyfriend. If you don't have sex, they won't like you anymore. It's just so much, too much do or die kind of feelings, you know? And I wish I'd known a little bit more that I could have said, get out of here.
One key element in the plot is revenge. The girls avenge themselves on men who've abused them or their friend, or either sexually or physically. I thought it was interesting to hinge action in a movie about girls, high school girls, on revenge and not have them turn to the police or parents or school. And I was thinking, in a sense, that's shocking because most people think women would come up with something other than physical violence, that feminine revenge is supposed to be subtle and smart and undercutting and emotionally manipulative. Is that the stereotype that you're playing against?
Well, we played around with that a lot. And, you know, we had 400 pages of improv material. You know what I mean? So there was a lot of different ideas about that. There was a couple, we went to the cops, da-da-da-da-da. And we just realized, I think a lot of women feel also sometimes that there's nowhere to go when they've been raped. You know, that classic, you get the double rape when you go through the police station and then the trial and all that, you know? And that was so apparent. There was no one to go to. We had to take care of it ourselves. And the only thing we could really do was to just go there with ourselves. We wouldn't have taken a gun or a knife, you know, and gone to that level.
I think one thing that we came upon in the actual, like, writing of this and in the process is that these girls were smart enough to know that if they went to someone else, some kind of authority figure, they weren't really going to get the reaction that they thought they deserved. They were, I think their problems really echo the situation that happens to many, many women, which is that, oh, well, you know, with Emma, you know, this guy, you know, I was in a car with this guy and he raped me. When did it happen? It was last October. Oh, it happened last fall. You know, what exactly, now that she's finally able to share this with her friends, what exactly are they going to do about it? And if they do go to an authority figure, what kind of treatment are they going to get? How are they going to be doubted? What kind of physical evidence will there be? You know, there's this whole, I think they are, even though they haven't gone through the process in years of experiencing this, they're really savvy to the fact that really doing the kind of official thing at this point is probably going to be just as painful as going through this experience itself, and that they're probably more capable of taking care of it, you know. And well, then as the story goes on, they feel that much more confident to take things into their own hands as well, and almost do it with a little bit of aloofness, because they're a little they're kind of giddy with the little bit of power that they find themselves with. And I think that alone kind of, you know, propels them.
There's a great moment when the girls joke that if this were a movie, then they would have shot 50 people already, and they'd be wearing lipstick, crying about how they don't know how to hold a gun. It made me think that it must have been great revenge for you, Lily, to be able to spoof the movie renditions of women out for revenge.
Absolutely. I hate that. I hate all that stereotypical, she has a gun, but she's crying, all that stuff. It's like, let's just break it down. We don't know how a woman is when she's taken. We haven't seen it. Let's just first clean the slate and see, you know? And I thought Girls Town was a really good, I thought it was just perfectly orchestrated. I thought when we confronted the guy and walked away, it was so anticlimactic. It was so appropriate to who they were, you know? I just loved it.
The film has an R rating. Do you think it's justified? And explain it to me.
Well, I don't know the exact rules about how they decide these things. I definitely don't think it's justified, and I think that time after time we're seeing films basically censored from the view of younger people, who in this case in particular are given the freedom and the availability to see films where people get shot, people get blown up, people are assaulted with racism and sexism and an endless series of real violence, you know. And when we made a film that speaks to the real high school experience, that those ideas are being blocked from kids. And I think it's a real problem. You know, we complain about it over and over again, and I think we've just accepted, well, that's the system and that's the way it is. What I'm hoping is that a lot of older adult women go to see Girls Town and, you know, recognize what kind of a role it can play in the lives of young girls, and will go back to see Girls Town with a young person. And, I think it's really a good story for girls over 14, I would say. And I'm hoping that, you know, older women can facilitate younger women seeing it, since we don't have the rating that allows for just anyone to go in. I also think young kids are pretty good about sneaking into films when they really want to see them. So I would encourage all the young women out there to, you know, buy a ticket for The Rock and then go sneak into Girls Town instead or something like that.
Put on some makeup.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot for joining me today on Fresh Air, both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Jim McKay is the director of Girls Town. Lily Taylor stars in the film. Girls Town opens next Wednesday in Los Angeles and around the country in the fall. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Technical direction from Audrey Bentham. Our engineers this week are Rich Parker, Chris Fraley, and Thad Kirk. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $15.45 and includes shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, a black man's tribute to his white mother. We talk with James McBride about his memoir, The Color of Water. His mother was born an Orthodox Jew, but when McBride was growing up, she refused to admit anything about her past. It wasn't until recently that she opened up to her son. Join us for the next Fresh Air.